Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Dialogue Out Loud series. I'm Taylor Petrie, editor of Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. Today, we're excited to have with us Elizabeth Mollum, a PhD student in history at Claremont Graduate University and adjunct professor at Idaho State University. In her recent article, The Legacy of the 1960s New Era and Singing Mother's Tour on LDS Gender Roles in and the Family in Great Britain, she explores a long-standing LDS practice of traveling choirs. It also became a way for the American church to export gender roles and family models among its international members and around the world. Elizabeth, welcome. It's so nice to talk to you about your work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Taylor.
So let's talk a little bit about the basics. How did you learn about the Singing Mothers Tour in Britain, and what is it?
Well, I kind of stumbled across it, really. I actually know someone in England, kind of a distant family member of my husband, whose mother was in the Singing Mothers Tour in Britain in 1961. And he sent me, when I first moved to America, an original program and itinerary and things like that. And so that was at the back of my mind. But then when I started to just research and the era, because I'm really interested in the 1960s, that's how I kind of came across it again, because it was a really big thing in the early 60s, this tour that was done in Britain to promote the church and because they kind of saw it as a new era, and that's what they called it, literally the new era, in the 60s, and the choir kind of really kickstarted and that era, and was seen as a huge occasion and opportunity. I mean, it was even televised on the BBC and played in the Royal Albert Hall. That's like one of the biggest stages, and so kind of really looking into as well what it meant to those women. And I think I recall someone even, in my lifetime later on, like just mentioning it, the Singing Mothers Tour, it remained in these women's memories and it was really important to them. And so I really wanted to look at, what impact did it have other than just being a missionary tool? What did it have? What impact did it have on the actual women themselves? And how did they translate it into their membership and the meaning of their membership?
So this was a choir composed of amateur LDS women from around Britain. And they performed, as you mentioned, all around Britain. And tell us a little bit about how people were selected and what kind. I mean, you said they performed in some of the biggest venues. It's televised. How long did this go on? What are some of the details that we know about this adventure?
Yeah. Okay. So Singing Mothers Choir, that was just another name for Relief Society choirs. Like there were Singing Mother choirs all over the world, loads of them. And so most districts or wards had one, but when it was decided by members in America and that they were going to have a concert series done by members of the church in Britain. They decided, it was going to be a Singing Mothers Choir made up of selected women throughout the country, 200 women. And so they were selected from different areas. I'm trying to remember if they auditioned. So I don't want to state that they auditioned when I can't remember. But either way, 200 women from districts all over the UK. And a lot of these women, they could sing, but a lot of them weren't musically trained. They were natural singers, some of them couldn't even read music. It was kind of a tall ask for a lot of these women. And also, this is like the early 60s we're talking about. So Britain, at that time, you know, it wasn't experiencing the economic boom that America did so soon after the war. It came later in Britain. And a lot of people are not very rich. Very few people have cars, and let alone a piano or music lessons. And, you know, and a lot of members come from backgrounds with less means. There are a few richer members. But even still, in Britain, most people are struggling. But it is the beginning of you know, the economic upturn. And so people are optimistic. But so it was really difficult for a lot of people because, you know, the church is so spread out. And if there's a rehearsal, you know, once they selected these women, like 100 miles away, they've got to work out how I'm going to get there. Kind of thing. So it was women all over the place. And I know part of me thinks it's wonderful that they're from all over the place, but translated into England, it's like, how are these women going to do that kind of thing? But going back to the actual structure of it, so there were 200 women and they had to learn their pieces locally. They had to, you know, they were given the music and they had to learn independently, maybe with a couple of other people in their ward or branch district that were doing it. And then 50 people came over from America to supplement it, like strong singers kind of thing. And also Florence Madsen, the conductor, she was like one of the brainchilds behind this whole thing. And so just like the week before the concerts, they all got together and did rehearsals all together before they went on this tour.
So before we get into a little bit more of the specifics about your findings, I want to just look at one other part of the research, because there were some really innovative things that you did. You not only had found, as you mentioned, some documents or had been become aware of this through like a documentary history, but you ended up actually interviewing people who were involved in it. How did you kind of make those contacts, and what are some of the things that you discovered there?
Oh, no, the people that I interviewed for the article, they weren't involved in the choir, and they were converts at that time. So their stories interested me because they kind of just supported the whole argument about how when expectations transfer, like there's something's lost in translation, or you have to, you know, reconfigure. So the oral history interviews, kind of were used to support the main underlying argument of, you know, yeah, transition between countries of what religion looks like in one place compared to another.
Right. Okay. Thank you. That's super helpful. So, so this is a fascinating, again, study of bringing in those oral history interviews to sort of shed light on the period, the documentary evidence about this Singing Mothers tour. And you also mentioned another term earlier that I just want to define a little bit for us, which is the new era. Many Latter-day Saint readers might associate that with the magazine, but tell us what it means in this context.
Right. I thought the same thing. I was like, new era, like, did they bring out the magazine? And but no, the new era was initiated when the London Temple was dedicated, like in 1958. David O. McKay kind of announced to everyone in Britain, right, we're going to have a new start, like a fresh start. We have a temple and we're going to do a really big push for missionary work, and like, and everyone's going to be involved, and there's going to be massive efforts. People are going to be called as district missionaries, and this is going to support the building program. There were big plans for like 50 chapels in 5 years throughout Britain, and the members were going to help fundraise it. They were going to help build it, literally, and And the missionary effort was massively successful in that time. And we have the infamous baseball baptism, which is another essay, like another topic completely. So you have to take the numbers with a pinch of salt because of that. But putting that aside, the whole baseball baptism program, there was, in fact, huge growth in this time where there was a surge of young people who were very charismatic and very, very zealous in joining this new faith. And a lot of them were young, teenagers, young adults, single. And they basically built the church in Britain and as we know it during that time. You know, baptisms, you know, just... yeah, ballooned like in that time. And there was a real sense of excitement. And yeah, it was really positive, which kind of reflected then British society at that time, that optimism. But a lot of these youth found and were able to express that optimism in a church setting, like they were put to use. You know, their parents were, you know, the greatest generation, you know, fought in the war and the and they've found something to do themselves and found something to put their passions and energy and belief into as well. And they were quite remarkable in doing that.
So this gets us into some of the details here. What was it like for women? And one of the great parts about this article is that it focuses on young women and women's experiences in this era of massive growth, the labor that they contributed to growing the church and the various projects that they were involved in. What was it like for them and what kinds of things did you find in the course of your research?
Mm-hmm. Well, because so many of these women that joined the church were single, so many and teenagers, when they joined, they didn't join as like a patriarchal family unit. They joined as individuals. And they're being told that there's this new era that, you know, that they have this big work to do. And so their Mormon identity from the beginning was based on that individual need and value that the church placed on them as individuals. And so, you know, so many of them spoke about how they contributed to literally building chapels, like laying patios, painting walls, not just the fundraising. Like they were so heavily involved. And also missionary work. There were so many sister missionaries, like district missionaries called, you know, to work part-time. And in some of them, you know, quoted, you know, in the Millennial Star and places like that, that, you know, we all work together. So, you know, I emphasize in my essay that the thoughts and the way that they viewed it was collaboration. That was the definition of the church. Like we collaborate, we work together to build Zion in Britain, to fulfill this new era. They didn't see it in familial terms or even hierarchical terms. It was very, very communal, back then. And also very British as well.
It's one of the fascinating pieces of your analysis here are kind of some of those gender dynamics. So how did you see that, like, empowering vision of the church for these young women playing out in the Singing Mothers Tour and in other aspects of the 1960s?
Well, like I said, they were heavily involved with what was going on. They're organizing, you know, countless activities and bazaars, and doing the labor as well. And they're also thinking of ideas of how to do these things, like creating little mini shops to create money organizing events, big concerts for fundraising and stuff like that. And so, yeah, they were just so heavily involved. And the language that was used, like especially in the Millennial Star, it wasn't gender specific either. Like it wasn't so much like the sisters are doing that and the brethren are doing that. It's like the ward is doing this, or so it was far more
cooperative, egalitarian,
and fluid, the role.
Yeah.
Like, you just every so often there's these little gems of like a brother cooked dinner for everyone, or like a sister did the emceeing, or you know, and so yeah, it didn't feel like we might have seen it later on, even in the following decades. And you see that, you know, if you read like every single millennial star, which I did from the 1960s, you start to see more gender role definition coming in, like in the later 60s, you know, as you know, correlation really starts to double down, and then you start to see a bit more of it. But not so much yet in the beginning of this new era. The women, and the way that they talked about the Singing Mothers tour as well, they saw themselves on the front line of the new era. Like they were the representatives.
They were the face of the church. Yeah.
They were. Yeah. It wasn't the missionaries. Like it wasn't the leaders. Like they were the ones. And they saw that. They were like, this is our mission. And, you know, and they believed that the repercussions of it would continue for a long time. Like they even compare themselves to the Tabernacle Choir tour that had happened in the 50s. They were like, yeah, we got so much more publicity. And like, ours was so much more successful. Like they really put a lot of weight on its importance and its value. And they claimed it themselves. It's quite amazing.
Well, and you mentioned that there are other ways in which their sort of presence there as the sort of face, as the leaders, as the representatives of the church, scrambles traditional gender roles as well in terms of home life. And they're singing mothers, but they're actually like away from home a lot because of this responsibility. So what are some of those other dynamics that are going on for them?
Yes. And this is all part of like the feeling that it was a collaboration, like the new era. And that's how I used the Singing Mothers tour as an example of the collaboration of the new era, like kind of an Uber example, because it's like, right. As I explained, these sisters are very sparse. They're spread out, you know, all over the country. A lot of them have very little means. And so in order to fulfill this task, which they see as a huge mandate, like calling and opportunity, they're going to think of ways how to make it happen. And like I read one sister like sold a car that they did have to buy a piano so she could learn the music. And you've got to remember at this time, it's like there aren't just chapels that they can just go down to and practice on, you know, because the chapels haven't been built like at this point. And also like people that use public transport, you know, and travel for an hour and a half to a rehearsal, like a district rehearsal, and so men had to fill in. And also you've also got to think like, a lot of these people are converts, like I said, and so they don't have necessarily the familial support of, you know, of extended family to in their church work. Some people might get that, some sympathetic parents whose daughter joined the church, but not always the case. And also a lot of women move away from their home to get married, and so they don't have lots of kin networks necessarily, and then the wards that they're in are huge areas spread out, and so even if two people in the same ward are in the choir, that could be in a different town still, and so they've got to collaborate to make this happen, and the men just have to step in with childcare. Especially and during the tour as well, like the men have to look after the children, and there is so many examples that I read of, you know, men, they're taking their holiday leave off work to stay at home with the kids, or they're taking the kids to work. And a lot of women said how willing their husbands were to do this. And it, you know, we say that, you know, that doesn't feel very abnormal today, but in the 60s, like, you know, a family who did this were in the local newspaper, and with the title, you know, men, you know, a man looks after family while woman goes off to sing. And so it caught the local press, you know, like people, Britain is very, very traditional at this time. But the whole new era and the whole excitement around it makes so many people willing to change these traditional gender roles, and also feel that it's God mandated to do this. And I mean, not all the time it worked. There's one case that I read that this woman just, they couldn't make it work, you know, her and her husband, and she had to leave the tour and go home, which must have been a huge disappointment because it was recorded. But and one example I put in the essay, but it was so long, I had to really reduce it. But it was this woman who described the arrangements that their family made so she could go on the tour or rehearsal with, and it was like there was a meeting held in the local unit, and they the Relief Society president, and they all get together, and loads of people are like, okay, I could have this child from this time to this time, and I could have this child from, and there were, and brothers and sisters in the ward, and they were working out, and they created this big schedule of when the children could be looked after so this woman could do this. And I think it's wonderful. I mean, I grew up in England, but I live in Rexburg, Idaho now, which is every single neighbor on my block's a member. And I literally have a group text that I send out. I need a babysitter from this time to this time. And people, oh, I can. And it's so easy. And and then I read about these women who just wanted to do this. And they just loved the value that it gave them and the purpose. And so they made it happen, and their husbands helped make it happen, and the ward helped make it happen. And I thought it was so wonderful.
I one of the things that I most loved about this, and readers will know that this was a part of a special issue that we did for Dialogue on the topic of the family. And I was very pleased to get something that was outside of the United States, and to sort of get a sort of a glimpse into global perspectives on this. So maybe as our last topic, what do you see the relationship in your analysis between the American church and the UK church in these years, and how that's also kind of contributing to the gender family dynamics and some of the other things that you see emerging there?
Well, and one reason I looked into this, it definitely has a kind of a personal touch to it. It's not obvious, but there's kind of a personal hidden agenda because, like, obviously, like, I lived in the UK till I was 32. And so, you know, all my childhood and adult life. And so that's a lot of experience. And I understand the church very well there. And when I came to America 10 years ago, I noticed such a difference in gender relations between men and women in the church, and also women's perspective of themselves in the church here. And I met Mormon feminists. I was like, what? because... like, gender is perceived differently here, and there's a lot more baggage that people carry here, so much more baggage, and I agreed with things that Mormon feminists were saying here, but at the same time I didn't understand how relevant, it was what they're saying, because I was basing it on my experiences in England, which even still is very much based on this collaborative attitude. The church in Britain would collapse without the women.
This is a common thing that I've discovered for people who do global Mormon studies is that a lot of the ways that other congregations around the world sort of say, oh, that's an American thing. The gender thing that they're doing, that's just like an American thing. And they sort of just ignore it. And that seems to kind of be what you were maybe discovering a little bit too, right?
Yeah. For the first few years, definitely. I was just like, what's your gripe? Like, women are like so equal in the church because we do like if just as much or if not more. Like, and women, I mean, there are discontented females in Britain, but they tend to be based on interactions with an individual who might have misogynist tendencies or something. It's they don't necessarily see the whole structure or anything as unequal. Especially this generation in the 60s, because they join the church based on their independence and individuality. Like it was, I mean, some couples joined, but right from the outset, they were independent.
Right. It was an act of independence to join because they had to rebel against their families and against their society. And
And they constantly asserted themselves. And also, they don't have the baggage of polygamy, like with the like generational baggage and things like that. It's very separate. And then they've also experienced in the society like more equality. Like it, you know, America is a very patriarchal society, not just the church, but just society in general. And so there's a lot more, just compounded issues, I think, for women here. But now I've been here 10 years. I empathize a lot more with like with Mormon women, and I definitely sympathize more and understand it a lot better. And now when I go back to Britain, I might discuss it with someone. I'm trying to help them see. Oh no, this is different for American women. So. But I don't know, but going back to your original question, I think like in Britain, and that's why I call it the legacy of the new era, because you do see, you know, the effects of that era, even though, you know, correlation doubled down, you know, and, you know, and there was emphasis in gender roles, you know, and, you know, women heard, you know, stay at home and things like that. It was still adapted. And the foundation of the church in Britain was still collaboration. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, we respect the priesthood hierarchies, but women continued to expect a voice, of like throughout all of that time, and you still see that now. And that's kind of what I go into later on in my essay about how the women throughout their lives later on continued to make decisions based on the expectation of collaboration. I don't know, I also mentioned it, you know, I think it's probably different for next generation because they're going to see things differently as well. Would be another study completely.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Elizabeth. It's been a huge pleasure to have you on the show to talk a little bit more about this research. We hope that our listeners have enjoyed the conversation and have learned something as well. Please check out Elizabeth Mollum, The Legacy of the 1960s New Era and Singing Mother's Tour on Latter-day Saint Gender Roles and the Family in Great Britain in the winter 2024 issue of Dialogue, and explore other resources on this topic there as well. To our listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. If you've enjoyed the episode, please share it with your friends and colleagues, and don't forget to leave us a review or to get in touch with any comments or questions. We hope that you'll tune in for future episodes, and please subscribe and rate the show, and be sure to check out the whole range of shows in the Dialogue Podcast Network. Thanks.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.